it that was like an epiphany, you know, when you're like, God, it's that easy. That's it. I was doing a little bit of cardio, but I was not doing much. I was mostly just lifting and controlling my calories, controlling my macros. And I was like, that was the easiest thing ever. I can't believe that that's actually all it takes to get super lean and stay lean.
Welcome to the Barbend Podcast, where we talk to the smartest athletes, coaches, and minds from around the world of strength. I'm your host, David Thomas Tao, and this podcast is presented by barbend.com. Today, I'm talking to fitness author, podcaster, and Legion Athletics founder, Mike Matthews. Mike's been referred to as a Swiss Army knife of the fitness industry, and that description has a lot of merit. He's explored almost every facet of strength training and nutrition, and he takes a super evidence-based approach to everything he does, whether it's programming workouts or formulating supplements. Mike is someone who is constantly exploring and expanding his own considerable knowledge of everything in strength, fitness, and nutrition. We dive deep on issues and misconceptions in the supplement industry, along with controversies in performance-enhancing drugs, and what the average person can do to safely enhance their exercise recovery. Also, I just want to say that we're incredibly thankful that you listen to this podcast. So if you haven't already, be sure to leave a rating and review of the Barbend Podcast in your app of choice. Every month, we give away a box full of Barbend swag to one of our listeners who leaves a rating and review. Today on the Barbend Podcast, I'm sitting down with the Swiss Army knife of fitness, as I like to refer to him, a man who has...
Somebody else called me that yesterday. I was on another podcast, and that's what they referred to me as. Is that the thing?
that's creepy, and you might have some precognition there, Mike. And that Swiss Army knife, and apparently I'm not the only one to think that. That's Mike Matthews. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Maybe I'll take that as that. I'll just start adding that to my own bio as Mike, the Swiss Army Knife Matthews.
Okay.
Like my wrestling name.
I got
it. Or is that my porn name? I don't know.
Interesting. Very, I don't want to think about that one too much, but I have to ask if you were referred to that, I thought I came up with that like completely on my own. I didn't talk to anyone about that. In what context did that come up on a recording yesterday?
Exactly the same. I was on someone else's podcast. They're introducing me, and they introduced me as the Swiss Army Knife. It was in the context of they're talking about content production, because I've written a lot of stuff and I've recorded a lot of stuff, and at least as far as a podcast goes, I've also done some video. I don't do too much video at the moment, but yeah,
that's interesting because you're not. I mean, there are a lot of. You could call it a Renaissance man. That was the one that I was like thinking in my head. And I was like, no.
That's more pretentious. Yes.
I was like, he's been called a Renaissance man before. I got to get more specific. Swiss Army knife. So, okay. Really?
Yeah. I actually prefer that. It's less pretentious. It's more practical. You know, anyone who calls themselves a Renaissance man or woman or a polymath is probably an arrogant prick.
Okay. I have a question. Were you in Boy Scouts or anything growing up? Like, do you have experience with multi-tools and Swiss Army knives?
Nope. Have I used a Swiss Army knife before? Maybe. I don't think so.
Well, maybe to give some context to listeners about how I came to that, and apparently not independently came to that new nickname, give us a little background on Mike Matthews and maybe your early journey through fitness, because later on in the broadcast, we'll talk more about what you're doing today and the multifaceted nature of your week-to-week work.
Sure, yeah. So I got into weightlifting like many guys because I liked girls. I was 17 and girls like muscles. So
or at least we tell ourselves that. I think guys like to think that girls like muscles sometimes.
I think the distinction there is guys like to think that girls like muscles more than they do and like a lot of muscle more than they do. I think it's biological essentially at this point that women are attracted to some sort of a bit of muscularity, a show of some physicality and strength. But you know, there's research on this. You probably know that if you take the average physique that a guy will aspire to, like the people on Instagram that, or the pictures that, that he has bookmarked, you show those to the average girl and she's going to say, no, that's too much. And we've probably all experienced, I've experienced that personally, even in my aspirations are, I guess more or less where I'm at now. Cause I know the reality is I'm not going to ever get much further than I'm at right now, but even stuff where I've seen that, like, yeah, it would require drugs for me to get there, but it looks pretty cool. My wife is like, no, that looks terrible. That looks way, way too much. So yeah, it's true. There's definitely a disconnect between what we think, what most guys think women are going to be attracted to and what they're actually attracted to. And really what it comes down to, and it's actually good news for guys, right? Because what it comes down to then is for most guys, they're going to get to, if they're driven primarily by the need to be more attractive to women, they'll get there probably in the first year or so, right? I mean, you gain, you're 20-ish pounds or so in your first year of muscle. If you're a good responder, maybe a bit less if you're not, or compliance is off or whatever. But you know, once you go from normal to like 20 or 25 pounds of muscle, in the eyes of most women, you have a great body now, even though you might look in the mirror and be like, I look like I don't even lift. You know, you go look on Instagram and you're like, I literally look like shit. Anyway, so that was a tangential way to say that that is why I got into weightlifting though. And see, I grew up playing sports. I played a fair amount of hockey growing up. And when I stopped playing hockey, I wanted to still do something with my body. And so it's like, all right, I want to stay active. I like doing something with my friends where I can like gather up a few guys and we can go work out together instead of play hockey together or whatever, and be more attractive to girls. Sure, let's do that. And that's why I started and how I started.
It's interesting to me because I was going to interject before your last bit there about getting a group of friends together to go to the gym, because there was a meme that went around a couple years ago, and it was guys start lifting, or it was, you know, it was a visual component, but basically was guys start lifting to attract girls or to, you know, attract whomever they're interested in romantically. But what happens is instead of just attracting a bunch of people who might be romantically interested in you, you start lifting and you just attract a bunch of really great bros or really great training partners. And you just make a lot of friends. You're looking for a girl. You're looking for a girlfriend or a boyfriend, but you just end up with a bunch of bros.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you start going to any gym regularly, and eventually you come out of your shell. You start talking to people. You realize that they're even people who, and this is maybe more so for women, but people who you thought were, they seem like they're complete assholes and, you know, because they never talked, and it turns out they're just kind of like into their working out, not really paying attention. And then you end up, whether you bring people or not, you end up with your little circle of friends that you get to see every day. And it becomes, I think that there's value in a little bit of a social element in it. Of course, if you're sitting there talking too much, then you're just going to be dragging out your workouts and actually become counterproductive. But that's something also that, yeah, I've experienced a number of times having worked out in a number of gyms over the years, or it's part of the, I think it's a fun part of the process is getting a feel for the regulars. At least, you know, for me, I've always tended to work out at the same time. So you have your crowd of people and, so yeah, there's also definitely a social component to it that's valuable.
You come for the gains, you stay for the friendship, so to speak. Well, Mike, when did fitness turn from something that you were doing with friends, doing to attract some members of the opposite sex, to your profession? And what was that growth and journey like?
So in the beginning, I just grabbed some bodybuilding magazines and started doing whatever was in there, right? And at the time, the most popular workouts were body part splits, bro splits, right? And so you do a bunch of volume for one major muscle group per day, rinse, repeat, which is actually not a terrible way of going about it. It's not optimal for somebody who's new, but you certainly can make progress. If you're in the gym doing enough hard work, you will make progress, especially in the beginning because your body responds so well. And I knew though that I didn't really know what I was doing beyond it was something. And I ended up kind of training that way. I guess there was a period where I worked with a number of trainers. So I was then exposed to some different types of training splits and training techniques and whatever. But it was a bit random for probably 7 years or so. I was consistent, but I was consistently kind of random in terms of what I would train and when and the exercises I would do and rep schemes and intensity and so forth. For a while, it didn't bother me because I guess I looked at it more as maybe exercise than training. I wasn't so much concerned with progress, as funny as that sounds, as just I liked the activity. Mm-hmm. And there was also a period where I didn't really even realize that I could do quite a bit more with my physique, and I wasn't too focused on that. It just wasn't like a big thing for me. I just liked working out and I liked the people I was working out with. But eventually I decided that if I'm going to be putting the time and the effort in, I might as well try to get more out of it. I might as well actually educate myself and try to apply myself in terms of understanding how this really works. Like, you know, up until then, I hadn't even heard of energy balance, for example. So, or progressive overload. And, you know, I'd heard a lot of things about how you're supposed to lose fat or what you're supposed to do to lose fat or types of things that you're supposed to do to gain muscle, but I hadn't heard those yet. So at that point, I decided to start educating myself properly, which was a pretty straightforward process. It's kind of just a grind, like it is with anything. When you really start out in something and start diving into the details and trying to sort the wheat from the chafe, so to speak, chaff.
I think it's chaff, but I know
it's probably chaff.
But I know what you mean.
Chaff, probably chaff. There's no e there. At that point, I started on the diet side of things, fortunately, we've understood, or at least the scientific community has understood, how our metabolism fundamentally works for a long time now. And so the scientific literature was actually pretty accessible for diet, because that's even more true now. There are a number of, for example, good reviews that, like, there's one in particular written by Eric Helms, and I think Alan Aragon is on as well, and a few others, that gives some great, it's just a great summary of nutrition for bodybuilding. And, but at the time, that paper wasn't published, but there were some similarly just, they were thorough and extensive, but also because they were reviews, they're also written in a conversational style, pretty easy to understand, right? And so that's how I learned about energy balance, and it made sense, right? And there's these things are also where you read about it and you're like, oh yeah, I guess that does make sense, and learn why calories matter, right? Why macros matter. And so from that, I didn't really have to, I felt like I didn't have to sort through too much bullshit. It was kind of just like, ignore all the fad stuff, ignore all the popular diets that come and go, and just stick to these fundamentals. And, you know, I remember, as you remember, as probably anybody listening remembers, the first time when I saw it work for myself, which I was at that time, I was also buddies with a bodybuilder and a powerlifter, and he was prepping for a show when I first met him, and he was already pretty lean. He was like a few weeks out, right? And so he helped me work out my calories and my macros the first time. So when I did that, and then I got pretty lean for the first time, probably like, I don't know, 8% body fat, right? So you have abs and the vascularity and muscle definition everywhere, and that was like an epiphany. You know, when you're like, God, it's that easy. That's it. I was doing a little bit of cardio, but I was not doing much. I was mostly just lifting and controlling my calories, controlling my macros. And I was like, that was the easiest thing ever. I can't believe that that's actually all it takes to get super lean and stay lean. But the training side of things is a bit more complex. And especially then, I think that since then, there's been a considerable amount of advancement that has occurred on the scientific side, where we have a better understanding now of what the primary driving factors are of muscle gain. But back then, that was less so. However, I did find my way to Mark Ripito. I found my way to Starting Strength and Practical Programming. I found my way to Lala McDonald and his stuff. So I found some good sources of information early on. And again, learned about some basics, mechanical tension, progressive overload, how important that is, and how it's more important than muscle damage and metabolic stress, and even more important than volume. Although we know now that volume is probably, it's a bit more important than we once thought. And it's certainly more important than frequency, for example, which back then, when I remember when I was looking into this, frequency was very much a thing. It was a lot of people were saying, if you were not training every major muscle group at least two or three times per week, you're an idiot. You're not going to make any progress, right?
I remember those days when it was always frequency of training sessions for muscle groups within a week, which was so interesting to me. And I remember thinking this was a long time ago. This was well over a decade ago. I do remember thinking to myself, well, your body, we operate in this week-to-week calendar as humans, these seven-day cycles, and that's just how our calendar works. But your body doesn't necessarily operate on those exact seven-day cycles, right? Like, my nervous system and my muscles don't know that exactly 7 days have necessarily passed. I was like, that always seemed like a very, even when that was kind of the thing du jour, that seemed like a very artificial way of applying a human-driven concept to biology, as opposed to vice versa.
Yeah, I definitely, viewing it through that lens definitely raises a red flag. And for me, there was also, I remember at the time, one of the major reasons why it was being said that you should be essentially training each major muscle group every couple of days, is that research research suggests that muscle protein synthesis rates only remain elevated for like anywhere from 12 to 24 hours after a workout. Now, we know a bit more now, like, for example, yes, that's the case in more highly resistance trained people. But in newbies, for example, they can remain elevated for 3 or 4 days after. We also know that there's a bit more that needs to go into recovery than just muscle protein synthesis rates. And yes, if we could, I guess, if we could go, regardless of our split, do a fair amount of volume and then we're enough volume to maximize muscle protein synthesis for, let's say, the next 24 hours. And then go and do it again. Sure, and then keep on doing that over and over. That theoretically would be optimal. But unless you're on a shitload of drugs, yeah, good luck trying to make that happen. Because if you look at how much volume that would equal per week, you're looking at like 30 or 40 hard sets per major muscle group per week. Good luck. Nobody can survive that naturally. I don't care. Yeah, ironically, there's someone who works with me here. He's 23 and he has good genetics for recovery and for lifting, not on drugs. And he was doing one of Greg Knuckles's crazy, it's like the most ridiculous lean bulking program you could ever imagine. Essentially, it was like 30 to 40 hard sets for the major muscles, for the big ones, not for your biceps and your shoulders, but for your back, for your legs, for your pressing, right, per week. And you were bench pressing and leg pressing every day, for example. That's how you started every single workout, and then doing a bunch of squatting and deadlifting and everything else on top of that. And he was able to do it. He was eating close to 5,000 calories a day, keeping his fat at like 50 to 60 grams a day. He was eating 1,000+ grams of carbs a day with like 60 grams of fat.
This is an immense amount of dialing in everything and just throwing everything you have at the wall.
Everything. Yeah. So think about that though, what that meant. He was eating, like, for example, a loaf of bread every day, because you got to keep your fat low to minimize fat gain. Anyways, so he was able to survive it he wanted to do 8 weeks and he just called it quits at 6 weeks because he's like, everything hurts. Like, every joint hurts. It was fun. And in the end, when he cut the fat that he gained, which was not as much as you would think, eating that much food. I mean, I guess he was also working out. He was doing 2 a days also, so he's working out like 3 hours a day. But when he, in the end, he gained probably around 4 pounds of muscle in 6 weeks, and his training age was, when he started that, I want to say he had probably a year and a half of good lifting under his belt, maybe 2 years. So I mean, that's pretty good for now. He had to work tremendously hard for it. But anyways, so my point is that with frequency, there's a theoretical optimum, but then there's reality. that where, yeah, but you can't do enough work and recover from enough work to just keep muscle protein synthesis rates maximized all the time. You do have to let them come down. Your body still has to recover.
I come from a weightlifting background, and the thing that was really popular about, that was becoming popular about 10 years ago in American weightlifting. Now, this was before weightlifting in America had kind of had a renaissance, largely due to a lot of people attributed to CrossFit, differences in governance for the sport in the US. But around that time, around 2009, everyone said, well, the reason America isn't succeeding on the international stage is our training frequency is too low. We need to train like the Bulgarians do and go to maximum 3 or 4 times a day and have, you know, 21 to 25 sessions a week. And we're maxing out our clean and jerks, and we're maxing out our snatches, and we're maxing out our front squats and back squats every session, and we're eating candy all day just to have enough, you know, simple carbohydrates, just to have enough glucose in order to maintain that volume. And no one can do that drug free. It's just so many people I knew were into that, were taking time off of school to do that because you're literally living in the gym, and they were all just getting injured and just ramming their heads into the ground proverbially because doing that drug-free, that kind of frequency drug-free, I don't care if you're a powerlifter or you're a weightlifter or you're a bodybuilder, you're going to hit a wall really quickly, and you just can't power through it.
Absolutely. And if you're actually truly drug-free, to try to make it in competitive weightlifting naturally is stupid, I think. Like, why would you even bother? At the top, everyone is on drugs. Everyone, you think Icarus, you think that whole thing was just them? Are you fucking kidding me? All right, look, so you have people who are on drugs doing certain things, right? Putting up certain numbers, depending on what sport we're talking about. And then you have these other people, and we find out those people are on a shitload of drugs to do that. So what you have is you have the best genetics you could ever want. That's why they got that far as well. You have the work ethic, you have everything, plus you have a shitload of drugs. And then you have these other people over here who are beating them supposedly naturally. Oh, okay. So people who, I love it when people, they'll speak out of both sides of their mouth. They'll say, on one hand, how big of a difference drugs truly do make. And if we're talking about weightlifting, anybody who would say otherwise, I would just not even respond to it if they were to say anabolics don't make that big of a difference. They don't help you really get that much stronger. Yeah, literally I have nothing to say other than, okay, the evidence is overwhelmingly clear that yes, they do. They help majorly with muscle and strength gain, right? So they'll say that, and then they'll also say that, oh yeah, no, it makes perfect sense that somebody can naturally do what somebody else who has equally great genetics has to take a shitload of drugs to do. So in the end. And this would be a different conversation, but drug tests of any kind they get beat every single day. Olympic drug tests get beat. And it's just, again, you have like someone in the Olympics getting busted for drugs. Oh, okay. Oh yeah. Fuck him. Or her. And then what about all the people though, that even beat them? You think they're not on drugs? So again, I think it's silly if somebody's getting into a sport where at the top, the vast majority of your competitors, if not literally all of them, are going to be on a lot of drugs and you're not willing to do that, why are you wasting your time?
Interestingly, I don't want to go too far down this particular rabbit hole. I agree with your statement that performance-enhancing drugs, anabolics, make a massive difference in weightlifting. A lot of people will say, oh, that's a powerlifting thing. No. It certainly does give...
Ironically, people all say the other thing. They'll say, oh, no, it's a bodybuilding thing.
It certainly does give an advantage. I do, and when I was making that statement about the Bulgarian system, I do think, and this is talking to a lot of folks who trained under that system back even in the Soviet Union, you know, it's just not tenable for the drug-free lifter. I will say, I do think, and I do truly believe, there are drug-free weightlifters who do have success on the international stage. I don't know for sure exactly, you know, I am not WADA, I'm not USADA, and I'm not those lifters. And you need to have perfect information from all three to know exactly who is lifting clean and who's not, right?
Yeah.
But I do believe, however naive this is, I do believe that there are great lifters who have success on the international stage who are doing it drug-free today. I wasn't around in the 80s. I wouldn't necessarily say that then across the board. But
I'm sure today's numbers are only probably better than the 80s, right?
It depends on the weight class. A lot aren't. So we had just had, I mean, there are, I mean, the body weight classes have changed a lot. They've restructured the body weight classes a significant number of times. Many of the highest Sinclair totals of all time in weightlifting were set in the 80s and early 90s. And there was a long period of time in the early 2000s, especially, where people weren't even coming close to a lot of those old numbers from a lot of like the Bulgarian system, the Soviet system, things like that. Not true for every single weight class, but I will say I think that performance enhancing drugs can make a huge difference across any strength sport. And I don't think any strength sport is the exception there. And I think any strength sport that thinks it's entirely 100% clean is wrong, right? I don't think any athlete from any sport can claim they're 100, that everyone in the sport's 100% clean. I think it's incredibly naive. I mean, the day of this recording, we had an article go up on Barbend today about how 5 members of the Egyptian national team in weightlifting just tested positive. I mean, there were several countries that weren't competing at the Rio Olympics in weightlifting because of positive drug tests. So it's certainly something that it was not just a problem in the 80s and we fixed. And I think to your point, people are still finding ways to beat the tests across strength sports. So that was maybe a bit of a tangent we got off on, but there's no perfect argument for either side. And I think that, it's constantly something where athletes and drug testing authorities are always going to be, at least some athletes and drug testing authorities.
It's a cat and mouse game, right?
They're always going to be intention.
Yeah. And to that point, you definitely, you certainly know a lot more about competitive weightlifting than I do. And I guess I should qualify everything I said with, I was thinking more with the best in the game. I was thinking more of like the minority of lifters who are enjoying the majority of success. I think it's certainly reasonable to say that if you have the genetics and you have the time and the inclination, you're willing to put in the work and it all can come together, that you can have some success in a sport like weightlifting without drugs. But, and maybe this is, maybe I'm too cynical and maybe I'm wrong, but this is how I look at it personally. If I don't have the genetics for strength, I was never a very strong person, but let's say I did and I was considering it seriously, I would think it naive for me to think that like, oh, I can reach the top of this sport natural. That's naive. Now, if my goal was just like, hey, I want to be able to show up. I want to be, even if I'm kind of bottom of the pack, if I'm 25th percentile or something, I'm happy because one, I know I'm natural. So I have a big disadvantage here. And two, taking it in context, I never expect to set any records or make a big splash. That would make sense to me. But to think that, I could go all the way naturally I think that would be naivete.
Well, that's actually a pretty good segue because so much of what you do and, I first came across some of the content you were producing as the founder of Legion Athletics and producing supplements in that realm. A lot of what you do is targeted at, and the content you produce and really your whole brand ethos, it's targeted at the person who's trying to optimize their performance, whether that's looking a certain way, lifting a certain amount, doing so naturally or doing so without the use of banned performance enhancers, right? So how does that ethos of you have chosen to do, to train a certain way and to have a certain approach to health and fitness, how has that carried over into the company you've built, you think?
So our focus has been on, for example, the fact that we don't use any artificial sweeteners or food dyes or flavors, and not because those chemicals are as bad as some people would have you believe. The alarmists would say that just a serving or two of, sucralose a day is going to destroy your gut. No, it won't. But 10 to 15 servings a day might not be every day for months or even years on end, might not actually be good for your gut, which can impact many different physiological symptoms in our systems. And the symptoms can be it can be hard to diagnose because it can manifest in different ways, right? And again, that's something that just I believe in personally. Do I, am I afraid of chewing some artificially sweetened gum? No. Or am I afraid of having some Splenda in, you know, I guess I don't really even have Splenda in anything, but if it were in something I was going to be eating or whatever, no, not a big deal. But I do think it's smart to minimize my intake of these chemicals. And so that was early on. That was a decision, though, that it maybe someone listening could be like, yeah, that makes sense. Sure. Make your supplements all natural, because, you know, when I started Legion, it was a big part of it was scratching my own itch and making the stuff that I wished other people would make. And so I knew I was going to be taking quite a few different supplements per day. I was going to have a pre-workout. I was going to have a post-workout. I was going to have a greens supplement. I was going to have probably 2 or 3 scoops of protein powder per day and possibly other things as well. And when you start adding all that up, if all that were artificially sweetened, it would add up to a fair number of servings every day. But one thing that many people don't know is to do that actually is quite expensive. Like, for example, the flavor system of there are several of our products that the flavor systems, which include the sweetening, cost up to $5 per bottle. That's the cost to do it naturally. If I were using artificial chemicals, it could be as low as 50 cents.
That's a 10x markup that you, as the producer of the supplement, have to incur.
Just eat. And people are maybe willing to pay a little bit more for 100% natural products. Like, truly, not every ingredient is natural, no chemicals, and the sweeteners and the flavoring and the food dyes, which even natural food dyes that are gotten, let's say beets or something, if you want some red, like, that stuff is expensive. So, you know, I pay quite a big premium as the producer of the products to do that. And you add that on top of formulations that are expensive as well. But I believe in it. I believe in it personally. I think it's the smart thing to do for myself, and therefore I think it's the smart thing to do for others. And it's, in a way, it's how I would want to be treated as a consumer, basically. And as I am probably I'm my best consumer of my stuff, it works in that way. Of where to your point of, like, you know, I have. I don't know if I would say, maybe you could say philosophical ideas, not in the sense of, like, what does existence mean, but I have certain lenses that I view my training and my diet and just kind of my life and lifestyle through. And those definitely carry over to the supplement brand. And that's one way. The other way I mentioned would be spending a lot on the formulations themselves and working with people who know a lot more about supplementation than I do, and giving them real budgets to work with. And that has allowed us to produce really high quality products at the expense of profits, though. Like, my cost of goods hovers around 50 to 60% of revenue. And by business standards, that's bad. Like, just a business person who doesn't understand or doesn't care about the ins and outs of what I'm talking about would be like, you're stupid. That needs to be 30 or 40%. That's business standard, right? But the problem is, if you're gonna make supplements, you can't have great products and great margins. You can just pick one. And I choose to have great products and not so great margins. And there are various reasons for that, and I'll stop here and see where you want to go next. But those are a couple examples of, I guess, how my personality kind of overlays on Legion.
Well, Mike, where that kind of takes my mind, and the question I will ask is, what is a product that maybe you've wanted to produce via Legion that you haven't been able to make work, either on a cost basis, and it's just not, you know, economically feasible. We can't sell this for what people would pay for it, and, you know, based on our costs as well. But also, it could also be for just product availability. Maybe you can't produce something that you really want to produce and you really like at scale in order to roll it out to a wide market. So is there any product that is maybe possible to produce, but you haven't been able to make it work from a business standpoint for either of those reasons?
Yeah. So I'd say there are certain ingredients we've run into that, like I have a greens product and we wanted to put anthocyanins in the pigment in blueberries. And to get a good dose, it was going to cost $30 a bottle for that one ingredient. All right. Anthocyanins are out. Now, what many supplement companies would do, though, is they would put literally like 1 milligram of them in a prop blend and just call it out in the marketing. It has anthocyanins, anti-cancer properties. These things are so neat. But we don't do that. So it's either an effective dose or nothing, right? That's how we approach ingredients. And so we had to cut that out. PQQ is another great, it's just a great molecule that we would love to put in. There would probably be, the best place would probably be our multivitamin, but it's too expensive. So what we may end up doing is selling it as a standalone ingredient. At least that would work. It's just to get a good dose. It would add, I don't remember off the top of my head, I want to say it was upward of $7 a bottle or $8 a bottle for one ingredient in a product that has currently 14 ingredients in addition to all the vitamins and minerals. So, you know, everything's a trade-off, right? And so we have to consider that with ingredients.
I'm gonna solve your business problem here. So what you do is you send folks two cartons of refrigerated blueberries with each order. That's probably not going to be more than like at scale, more than like a $12 cost. I just saved you $18 on that product. I've done it.
But then people are going to complain about the calories. They don't want to waste 100 calories on blueberries.
then peel them. Maybe include the world's tiniest blueberry, like a proprietarily designed blueberry peeler. Just so they can get the skins, and then a mortar and pestle. So after they dry them, they can grind them down. Process there your we own. Go. It's a do it yourself.
30 years of genetically engineering blueberries to create the ultimate anthocyanin supplement.
It's a DIY project. People love that. People pay a premium for that. You can increase the margins. It's perfect.
So we've had that issue with ingredients. As far as products go, I would say a hormone booster or optimizer would be nice because there's a lot of demand for it, but there's nothing natural that we feel strongly about that makes us want to actually do a product. We wouldn't be able to stand behind it like we do the rest of our products and the individual ingredients. And so just for anybody listening, if you want to see what I'm talking about, if you go to legionathletics.com and just check out any of the sales pages, you'll see they're very in-depth. I'm actually going through a whole process of updating them right now. So they'll start with a one-page kind of summary of the product. And if that's all you want to read, and you know, if you already are pretty much sold and you just want to know quickly what this thing is, fine. But if you keep going, there's a lot of information in terms of each ingredient, what that ingredient is, what it does in the body, why we chose to include it in the product, what is the clinically effective dose, how much is in every serving of the product, and so forth. And so when we've already, that's our standard in terms of, I guess that's more of a marketing thing. So as far as a hormone booster goes, what do we have? I mean, we have D-aspartic acid, which maybe does a little bit of something for like 2 weeks, maybe. And we have several ingredients that just do nothing, like tribulus and horny goat weed, and the stuff that you normally find in hormone boosting supplements do absolutely nothing. And even that also applies to estrogen blocking supplements. We're like, sure, if you take estrogen blocking drugs, they work really well, but there is no natural equivalent that works well enough that we are willing to stand behind it and sell it. And BCAAs, same thing. I get asked every week to make BCAAs, even from people who say, because I've written about BCAAs, I've spoken about them, and I'm like, they're worthless. You don't need them, period. And they're not going to help you gain muscle faster. They're not going to help you get stronger faster. They're not going to help you recover better from your workouts. Just don't waste your money on them. So every week we hear from people who basically say, hey, I know what you have to say about BCAAs. I don't even disagree. I think that the evidence also is pretty clear at this point, but I just like them. I just like drinking them. It makes my water tasty. Can you please make BCAAs so I can just give you my money instead of giving it to this other company that lies about them to sell them? And, you know, unfortunately, that's also not a great sales pitch. Like, hey, this is actually a useless product other than just, it makes your water tasty. This is if you don't want to, what are those little drops? So if you don't want to put fruit in your water or use those little flavor drops here, this is an alternative. So those are a couple examples of ingredients that we've liked to use and products that, hey, I wish, because there's a lot of demand for them, but I just, that's not what drives my business decisions. It's not just about, hey, can I make money?
Are there any products or ingredients, maybe is the better level of specificity here, that have surprised you in that maybe you thought they were particularly effective, or maybe you initially thought they were ineffective, and more research has indicated to you that your initial preconceptions or that your preconceived notions were maybe not super correct?
That's a good question. You know, it's good timing for that question too, because we are going through a whole round of reformulation, because it's been now, this is year 6 for Legion, and there have been some tweaks and updates, but not a real kind of stem to stern, I wouldn't say overhaul, but review of each product and looking at, again, now, because there's, in some cases, more research has come out. In other cases, the people, again, who I work with, and really the person who drives that whole process is, his name's Curtis, and he's the co-founder, and he's the former lead researcher and writer over at Examine.com. So anybody who's familiar with Examine.com, all that technical stuff on the website and all the 40,000 plus citations, that was Curtis.
Yeah, Curtis Frank is in many ways a legend in supplement research circles online.
And rightfully so. I mean, he's the Gandalf of supplementation, right? And so I really enjoy working with him, because he is truly, truly an expert and truly a professional in that regard. And also a funny dude, though. He's a fun person. I'll have him on my podcast, and it'll be like half weird jokes and half talking about serious stuff, right? And so Curtis is driving that. And then he oversees the advisory board, which includes guys like Menno Henselmans and James Krieger and Eric Helms and other respected people in the evidence-based fitness space. And so we're going through reformulating stuff right now. And I would say most of it is not that much is changing. There are some ingredients that, and I'm going to give Curtis more of the credit here than me, that he thought, like, he believed in because of what we understood at the time in terms of the mechanistic properties. And even if it was preliminary animal research, which we would explain that in the copy, we would say there, you know, animal research suggests that this could do this. And we're not saying this is a primary ingredient, like hordenine is in one of our fat loss products, Phoenix. And that's one example. There is an example called it's a molecule called rutacarpine that comes from a fruit, it's like a little berry from a plant. And it's in our sleep supplement, and it's there to help the body, at least the idea. And it's explained why we believe, or why Curtis believes, that this probably does work, and it can help your body get rid of caffeine quicker by just increasing the activity of an enzyme that helps break it down. And so now he's taking that out, right? And the reason he's taking it out, though, is not because he believes it doesn't work. And even though there hasn't been more research on it, because it's a pretty obscure thing, and the research that is there is rat research, which should raise a red flag for people who are, if you're reading through something and you're actually checking citations and it's rat research, because we're not just big rats, but shouldn't also just be immediately thrown out. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It doesn't mean that there's something misleading about it. It depends how this is being presented, right? And so in the case of rutacarpine, we're saying, hey, this is what we know about it. And there's also some other research that is outside of, it doesn't have to do with caffeine metabolism, but we do understand some of the mechanisms here. And it would make sense, because it does upregulate this enzyme. This is the enzyme that processes caffeine, gets it out of the body. By upregulating it, you're going to help with that. But he's taking it out because now, as he has continued to research and just expand his understanding of not just supplementation, but biology, he's just like, you know, I don't like that there's no, the research hasn't progressed at all on this molecule. And I don't actually really like the idea of, if people are going to be taking the supplement every day, I don't like the idea of kicking this enzyme up every day, because it does have some other physiological mechanisms that come into play. I want to remove it, and I'm going to replace it with something else that I think would be more beneficial. So, I'd say because I started working with Curtis from the beginning, we started with a really good foundation. And from there, it's been more about just tweaking things. One other example quickly is ornithine. Ornithine, an amino acid involved in the Krebs cycle, generation of energy, was in Pulse because there's some evidence that it can be good for like longer endurance activities. But we took it out eventually because it was basically, the effect was not all that significant. And again, this was a throw in because it's not very expensive and there is some evidence. And for people who are doing longer kind of endurance heavy activities, it may help them a little bit, but the effect is not huge. It was a little bit redundant physiologically because of the citrulline malate. So that's something that came out. But I can't think of an instance where there's an ingredient where we're like, oh, this is it. Like, you know, remember when HMB, it probably still is being promoted, maybe not as mainstream, because a lot of the big brands were on the HMB train hard as of just a few years ago, really, saying this is essentially the next creatine, right? This is going to really boost muscle and strength gain. And now we know it does not. The evidence is clear. It absolutely does not. And so we have had HMB in one of our products, not for the purpose of muscle and strength gain, but simply for anti-catabolic purposes, because it's in a product that is meant to be taken when you're fasted, you know, you're fasted training, right? So it's when you're doing fasted training. So there's yohimbine, which is for fat loss, which drives fat loss. And then HMB is also included in the product because if you're training in a fasted state, protein breakdown rates are going to be a bit higher, and especially after you work out, depending on when you eat. And so it was something that we thought was not crucial, but it was a neat inclusion and a warranted inclusion in a product that's specifically meant for fasted training. So there haven't been any major flops that I can think of, more just incremental improvements and again, I'm going to give Curtis and the Scientific Advisory Board the credit there, as their understanding and very much Curtis the credit, as his understanding of the world of supplementation has continued to evolve. He comes and says, hey, what do you think about these ideas? And, you know, again, it's a fun process to go through because he's very good at it.
Well, Mike, I referred to you as a Swiss Army knife earlier in the broadcast, and I'm actually still upset that I wasn't the first one, even the first one this week, to refer to you as that on a podcast. But where is the best place for folks to stay up to date with both what's going on with Legion Athletics and also what you're doing and the content you individually are driving out?
Just legionathletics.com is really the hub now. So that's where all of Legion's products are. We also have a coaching service. We have meal plans. We have more than just supplements. And we have a blog where there's probably close to 1,000 long form articles now that I've written. And most of them written by me. Anything that's published under my name was written by me. We also have a few writers now these days who work with me, that's published under their name. So probably about 1,000 articles there covering pretty much everything you could want to know about improving your body composition. And I couldn't say improving everything you want to know about improving your health, because that's so vast, but we have a lot of health related stuff too. And I have a podcast called Muscle for Life, which you can find wherever you like to find podcasts to listen to, but also we have all the episodes up at legionathletics.com. And I'm kind of active on Instagram. I don't really like social media, so I don't give it too much of my time, but I can be found and contacted there as well.
Excellent. Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today, and looking forward to hearing your voice on many podcasts to come over at Muscle for Life. And if you're just listening now and you're a subscriber to the Barbend podcast, make sure to give Muscle for Life your subscribe and your listen as well. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you.